Part 4. Target. Engagement. In the phase of open warfare, especially when one is placed in a position of defending or countering, one must be proactive. Determine what commodities or resources you will need to gain the advantage and place your opponent on the defensive. Establish which of these commodities or resources your opponent possesses. Take them from him. Do not chase glory. Do not force unwinnable confrontations. Do not try to match his strength if you know his strength overmatches yours. Do not waste time. Decide what will make you strong enough, and then acquire those things. Your most desired commodity is always your continued ability to prosecute the war. Gilliman, Notes Towards Martial Codification, 14.2.11. Chapter 1, Mark 4.12.45. It gets light early. Another beautiful day on the estuary. The light's so good, all reckons they can get an extra hour or so's work done. An hour is an additional 2 loads of swartgrass. A day of hard labour for good returns. His hands are sore from the harvest work, but he has slept well and his spirits are good. Strong sunlight always lifts him. He rises, says a prayer. In the whitewashed lean-to at the back of the hab, there's a gravity shower. He pulls the cord and stands under its downpour. As he washes, he can hear her singing in the kitchen. When he goes into the kitchen, dried and dressed, she's not there. He can smell warm bread. The kitchen door is open and sunlight streams in across the flagstones. She must have just stepped out for a moment. Stepped out to get eggs. He can smell the swartgrass straw on the warm air. He sits down at the worn kitchen table. "It's time to get to work, Al." He looks up. There's a man standing in the doorway, backlit by the sun so that Al can't see his face for shadow. But Al Person knows him anyway. Al touches the little symbol around his neck, an instinctive gesture of protection. "I said..."
"I heard you. I'll get there when I'm good and ready. My wife's making breakfast."
"You'll lose the light, Al."
"My wife's making breakfast."
"She isn't, Al." The man comes into the kitchen. He hasn't changed. He wouldn't, though, would he? He never will. That confidence, that good-looking charm.
"I don't recall inviting you in," says Al.
"No one ever does," replies the man. He helps himself to a cup of milk.
"I'm not interested in this," Al says firmly. "Whatever you've come to say, I'm not interested. You've wasted a trip. This is my life now."
The man sits down, facing him. "It isn't, Al." Al sighs.
"It's great to see you again, John. Now get out of my hab."
"Don't be like that, Al. How have you been? Still pious and devoted?"
"This is my life now, John."
"It isn't," the man says.
"Get out. I don't want anything to do with anything."
"You don't have a choice, I'm afraid. Sorry. Things have escalated a little."
"John!"
Al almost growls the warning. "I'm serious. There aren't many of us, Al. You know that. You and me, we could set our hands on the table here and count them off, and we'd still have fingers spare. There never were many of us. Now there are even fewer."
Al gets up.
"Listen, John, let me be as plain as I can. I never had time for this. I never wanted to be part of anything. I don't want to know what trouble you brought to my door. I like you, John. Honestly, I do. But I hope never to see you again. I just want to live my life."
"Don't be greedy. You've lived several."
"John, come on, Al. You and me, Anatole Hive, come on. The Pan Pacific? Tell me that doesn't count for anything."
"It was a lifetime ago."
"Several, several lifetimes."
"This is my life now."
"No, it isn't." Al glares at him.
"I'd like you to go, John. Go, now, before my wife gets back from the coops."
"She's not coming back from the coops, Al. She never went out to the coops."
"Get out, John."
"This is your life, is it? This? An ex-soldier turned farmer, retired to a life of bucolic harmony, good honest toil in exchange for plain food and a good night's rest,
Really, Al? This is your life? This is my life now. The man shakes his head. And what will you do when you've had enough of that? Will you quit it and move on to something else? When you're tired of farming, what next? Teaching? Button making? Will you join the Navy? You might as well. You've been army already. What will you do? An ex-soldier? Farmer? Widower?
Widower?
All snaps, flinching from the word as though it was buzzing in his face to sting him. What are you talking about, widower?
Oh, come on, All. Don't make me do all the hard work. You know this. She's not out at the coop. She's not making you breakfast. She wasn't in here just now singing. She never came to settle on Calf. She was gone, the poor love, before you ever joined the army. Last time you joined the army. Come on, All. Your mind's a bit mixed up. It's the shock.
Leave me alone, John.
You know I'm right. You know it. I can see it in your face.
Leave me alone.
Come on. Think. All stares at him.
Are you in my head, John Grammaticus? Are you in my bloody head?
I swear I'm not, All. I wouldn't do that uninvited. This is all you. Trauma. It'll pass.
All sits down again.
What's happening?
He whispers. I haven't got much time. I'm not here long. Just talking to you is taking a huge effort. We need you, All.
They sent you.
I bet they did.
Yes, they did.
They did. But I didn't mean them. I meant humans. The human race needs you, All. Everything's gone to shit. So badly. You wouldn't believe it. He's going to lose, and if he loses, we all lose.
Who's going to lose? Asks All.
Who do you think?
What's he going to lose?
The war, says John. This is it, All. This is the big one, the one we always talked about, the one that we always saw coming. It's happening already. Bloody Primarchs killing each other, and the latest round of executions happens here, today, right here on Calf.
I don't want any part of it. I never did.
Tough shit, All. You're one of the perpetuals, whether you like it or not.
I'm not like you, John.
John Grammaticus sits back and smiles, pointing a finger at All.
No, you're bloody not. I'm only what I am now, thanks to Xenos' intervention. You're still a true perpetual. You're still like him.
I'm not. And I don't have what you have. The talents. The psych.
It doesn't matter. Maybe that's why you're important. Maybe you're just important because you're here. There are only three like us in the whole 500 worlds right now, and only one of them on Calf. Ground zero. That's you. This is down to you. You don't have a choice. This is down to you.
Get someone else, John. Explain it to someone else.
You know that doesn't work. No one else is old enough. No one else understands as much. No one else has the perspective. I tell anyone about this, they'll just dismiss me as insane. And I don't have time to spend another 18 years in an asylum like last time I tried it. You've got to do this.
Do what?
Get out of here. They're going to slide this world. An interstitial vortex, the old immaterium sidestep. You've got to be ready to step through that door when it opens.
And go where?
It's fallen dark outside. The sun's gone in. Grammaticus looks up and shivers.
You've got to get something, and you've got to bring it to me. Step through the door when it opens and bring it to me. I'll wait for you.
He hesitates.
I'll try my damnedest to wait for you anyway.
Where am I going, John?
It's getting dark so fast. Grammaticus shrugs.
We're running out of time, All. With your permission, I'll show you.
Don't you bloody di-
Mark, unspecified. Somewhere. It stinks of the warp, of burning void shields. The walls are polished ebony and etched ceramite, inlaid with crystal and ivory and rubies. Gold leaf edges the hatch frames. The place is so big, so very big. Vaults and chambers, dark and monumental, like the naves of cathedrals. Of a tomb, of a necropolis catacomb. The ground is black marble. It's not the ground. It's a deck. He can feel the throb of engines coming through it, drive engines. The air is dry, artificially maintained. He can smell smoke.
"Why can I smell smoke, John?" he asks.
He can't read whatever it is that's etched into the polished walls. He realizes he's glad he can't.
"John? Where did you go?"
There are star fields outside the windows. There's blood on the floor. Bloody footprints on the marble, bloody handprints on the walls. Tapestries have been torn down. There are bullet holes in the bulkhead panels. Craters blown by bolt rounds, gouges cut by lasers, by claws. There are bodies on the floor. It's not a floor. It's a deck. He can hear fighting. A huge battle. Millions of voices yelling and screaming. Weapons clashing, weapons firing. The din is coming up through the deck. It's echoing, muffled, through distant archways and half-seen hatches. It's as if monumental, cataclysmic history is happening just around the corner.
John?
There's no sign of John, but he can feel the back of the neck prickle of other minds, minds as bright as main sequence stars.
John, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here at all.
He moves forward, through an archway 20 times as tall as he is, into a chamber 50 times as tall. The walls and pillars are cyclopean. The air is filled with smoke and dying echoes. There is an angel dead on the floor, on the deck. The angel is a giant. He was beautiful. His sword is broken, his golden plate is cracked, his wings are crushed. Blood streaks his armour and soaks the Carnadon skin mantle he wears. His hair is as golden as his armour. He has teardrops on his cheek. His killer is waiting nearby, black as night, made of rage, masked by shadow. The edges of his war gear are chased with gold, giving his darkness a regal outline and shape. The gold encircles the eyes he wears on his chest and harness. Baleful, red, staring eyes. He fumes with power. He prickles hot like a lethal radiation leak. He's polluting the galaxy just by standing in it. There's a crackle, a fizzle. Malice so terrible a rad counter could pick it up. The killer is huge. His shoulder plates are draped with a cloak of furs and human pelts. A spiked framework surrounds his head. A psychic cage, an armoured box. There is a light glowing inside the box, a ruddy glow. The killer's head is shaved. He is looking down, his face in shadow. He is looking down at the angel he has just killed. Cortical plugs and biofeeds thread his scalp like dreadlocks. He is a beast made flesh and shod in iron. He is made of pure hatred. All person realizes he should not be here, anywhere in the cosmos but here. He starts to back away. The killer hears him move, or senses him. The killer slowly raises his massive head. Light seeps up from the gorget, underlighting his face. Arrogant, proud, evil. He opens his eyes. He stares at all.
I renounce you, evil one,
all stammers. He touches the little symbol around his neck, an instinctive gesture of protection.
You what?
I renounce you as evil.
There is no evil,
says the killer, his voice a landslip rumble of mountains falling.
There is only indifference.
The killer takes a step towards all. The floor, the deck, trembles under the weight. He halts. He's looking at something. He's looking at something in all's hand. All glances down, confused. He realizes he's been holding something in his other hand all along. He sees what it is. The killer makes a sound. A sigh. His lips part, connected by tiny strands of spittle. He looks all straight in the face. Straight into his soul. All turns away. He cannot bear to look into those eyes any more. He turns to run. He sees the light behind him. He was so captivated by the killer, by the prickling, enveloping darkness, he almost didn't see the light to begin with. Now he sees it. It's not the light it used to be. It's not the light he used to know. The light is fading. It was once the most beautiful light, but it's dwindling. It's ebbing away and growing dim, golden, broken, like the angel, and like the angel brought low by the killer made out of darkness. Beyond the light is a vast window port, Through it, all sees the hazy glory of terror. The human home world is burning.
I've seen enough, says all person.
Mark 4:12-4:5. It's the shark, it's just the shark. You've been hurt, and I've shown you plenty. Plenty. I'm sorry, I really am. No one should have to see that. No one should have to deal with all of that in one go. But there really isn't time to be gentle about this. You saw what you had to see. I showed you where you have to go. Now, this will hurt. This will be hard. You can do it. You've done hard before. Come on, all. Come on, my old dear friend, Olenius. It's time to wake up. It's time to all wakes. No sunlight. No bed. No singing from the kitchen. Grey light. Fog. Cold. Pain. He's fallen on his back, twisted. His hands are sore, and so is his back, and one of his hips, too. His head feels as though iron screws have been driven into it. He sits up. The pain gets worse. All realizes the worst of the pain isn't his aches and sprains and bruises. It's the aftershock. The aftershock of the vision. He rolls onto all fours and dry heaves as if he's trying to vomit out the memory and be rid of it. It would be tempting to think it was just a nightmare. Tempting and easy. Just a bad dream that happened because he'd had a bump on the head. But all knows the human mind doesn't imagine things like that. Not like that. Grammaticus was here. The bastard was here. Not in the flesh, but as good as. He was here. And that's what he had to show. It says a lot that John made the superhuman effort and took such an immense risk to come. It says a lot. And what it says doesn't sit comfortably with all person. He gets to his feet, unsteady. He's battered and bruised. His clothes are caked in mud that's just beginning to dry and stiffen. He tries to get his bearings. There's not much to see. A dense grey mist is shrouding the entire world. There are rumbling sounds and dull flashes up behind the clouds. Far away, all's guess would be to the north, there's a glow, as if something big on the other side of the fog is burning. Something big, like a city. He looks around. The ground's a slick of stinking black mud and ooze, of mangled agricultural machinery and broken fence posts. This is the spew the tidal wave left in its wake. This is what's left of his land, of his fields. He stumbles along, his boots squelching in the muck. The thick fog is part smoke, part vapour from the flood. The ground stinks of mineral ores and riverbed mire. All of his crops have gone. He sees a line of fence posts, still standing. From the height of them, above the muck, the flood wave left about a metre of silt and soil behind it. Everything's buried. Worse than damned Crescentine Ridge. He sees a hand, a man's hand, sticking up out of the black ooze, pale and wrinkled. It looks as if he's reaching up, grasping for air. Nothing to be done about it. All reaches the fence posts and leans on one of them. He realizes that it's the gate at the end of the west field level. He's not where he thought he was at all. He's about half a kilometre west. The force of the floodwater must have carried him like flood litter, like flotsam. Bloody wonder he didn't break his limbs or get his brains dashed out against an upright post. It was a wonder he didn't drown. Realigned, he turns around and heads back the way he came. Now he's got his bearings, he knows where the farmhab is. He passes a cultivator unit on its side and half sunk in black mud. Then he finds the lane, or what used to be the lane. It's a groove of ooze, a muddy furrow knee-deep in violet water along its belly. He sloshes along.
Master Person.
He stops, shocked at the sound of a voice. A man sits at the edge of the track, his back against what's left of the fence. He's plastered in mud.
Who's that? Asks all.
It's me. It's Zibes.
Zibes. Hebert Zibes, one of the labourers, one of the pay-by-the-days. Get yourself up, all says.
I can't,
says Zibes. He's sitting oddly against the fence. All realises that the man's left arm and shoulder are wrapped to the fence post with barbed wire. They've become tangled together in the flood surge.
Hold on, says All.
He reaches into his belt, but his work tools are long since lost. He goes back to the overturned cultivator unit and digs around in the thick mud until he finds the toolbox in the cab. Then he comes back with a pair of cutters and sets Zybes free. The man's flesh is pretty torn up by the wire.
"Come on," says Ol.
"Where to?"
"We've got places to be," says Ol. It takes 20 minutes to trek across the mire, through the fog, to the farmhab, what's left of it. On the way, Zybes keeps asking questions. Questions like,
"What happened?" and "Why did it happen to us?"
Ol doesn't have any answers, none that he has the time or desire to explain anyway. 5 minutes from the hab, they come across Cat, short for Katerina. Ekaterina, something like that. Ol forgets. She's a paid-by-day too, like Zybes, works in the kiln store, drying the sheaves. She's about 17, his neighbour's girl. She's just standing there, in the fog, smirched in mud, looking vacant, staring at something there's no possibility of seeing because there's no distance visible, thanks to the fog. Maybe she's staring at something comforting, like the day before, or her 5th birthday.
"You all right there, girl?"
Ol asks her. She doesn't reply. Shock. Plain shock.
"You all right?
Cat?
Come with us." She doesn't make eye contact. She doesn't even nod. But when they start walking again, she follows them, at a distance. The hab is a mess. The flood wash swept right through it, taking away the doors, the windows and most of the furniture, leaving a half-meter carpet of silt and wreckage in exchange. Ol thinks about looking for that pict of his wife, the one that used to stand on the dresser in the kitchen. But the dresser's gone, so he doesn't see much hope of finding a picture that he last saw standing on it. He tells Zybes and Cat to wait, and goes in. His room's upstairs in the roof, so it's weathered the smash better than the rest. He finds his old service kit bag made of faded green canvas and packs it with a few useful bits and pieces. Then he strips off to his work boots and puts on dry clothes. The best he can find are his old army-issue breeches and jacket, also green and faded. He picks up a last few items, choosing things to take and things to leave. There's a spare coat for Zybes, plus a Medicaid pack and a blanket from the bed to keep Cat warm. He goes back down the stairs to find them. His old las rifle is still hanging over the fireplace. He takes it down. From the niche in the chimney breast, he retrieves a small wooden box. 3 magazines, fully charged. He puts 2 in his pocket and gets ready to slot 1 into the weapon. He hears Zybes cry out and rushes into the muddy yard, slipping and slithering. The bloody mag won't slot. It's been a long time since he drilled with a rifle, and he's forgotten the knack. He's scared, too, more scared than he's ever been in his life. And that's saying something, because his life has included Crescentine Ridge.
"What's going on?"
he asks, reaching Zybes, who has ducked behind a toppled stack of grass crates.
"There's something over there," he says, pointing at the side barn. "Something big, moving around."
Ol can't see anything. He looks around to check where Cat is. She's standing by the kitchen door, gazing at the past again, oblivious to Zybes' panic.
"Stay here,"
Ol tells the injured man. He gets up and moves towards the barn, rifle trained. He hears something move. Zybes wasn't lying. It is big, whatever it is. Ol knows he'll need a clear shot, a kill shot. If it's big, he'll need to stop it fast. He wrenches open the barn door. He sees Graft. The big loader servitor is rolling around in the barn, bashing into things. Mud and riverweed have totally baffled its sensors and visual systems.
Graft?
"Trooper Person,"
the servitor replies, recognizing his voice.
"Stay still! Just stay still!"
The big cyborganism halts. Ol reaches up and yanks the ropes of weed away. He gets a cloth and cleans the optics and gets the mud out of the fine sensor grids.
"Trooper Person," says Graft. "Thank you for the assistance, Trooper Person."
"Follow me," says Ol.
"Follow you where, Trooper Person?"
"We've got work to do," says Ol.